Turns out he's a major cinephile.
They don't watch enough movies! It's a very simple formula!
And here we go.
Hello, loyal listener. Welcome back to Nick Nat Goes to the Movies. I say this knowing it's been about a month and a half since our last episode. Hopefully my life has settled down a bit now that I'm in a new state, apartment, and yes, a new job. But to the podcast at hand, the premier pop culture podcast for, well, movie premieres. And with that in mind, I have loved being back in theaters, catching up on some of the latest to hit the big screen. This episode, we're talking about the latest end chapter in a franchise I love, but I've yet to talk at all about on this podcast, as well as the latest entry in a franchise we have had an entire previous episode dedicated to. I'm talking about the end movie of Daniel Craig's James Bond tenure, No Time to Die, and the latest entry in the new trilogy about Michael Myers and Jamie Lee Curtis's Laurie Strode Halloween Kills. And we are also talking about Dune, a sci-fi I don't really know a whole lot about, but that cast is stacked. So sit back and hear about three of the biggest October movies in the latest entry of Nick Nack New to Theaters, new-ish movies. So spoilers ahoy, avast ye be warned. So keep sailing along, yes ye be given a fate worse than that in Davy Jones' locker. Pirate talk over. And yes, I know a lot of these movies are not new anymore, but catch-up episode, that's what we're doing. So, No Time to Die. This movie was one of the first postponed by the COVID-19 pandemic. I remember being stoked to watch this one maybe a month after Birds of Prey was released, and that was after a few previous delays. But now, fall 2021, moving on to winter 2021 now, the final film from the Daniel Craig Bond arc is here. It dropped. So let's dive in and finally appreciate this movie coming out what seems like an eternity apart from Spectre, which came out back in 2015. I know. I'm as floored as you with just how long ago that movie was. So if you're familiar with the Craig Bond movies, you know more than ever before they made a linear Bond story that you have a clear beginning and end, much less villain of the week. The usual actors you've come to know from this are back, Christoph Waltz and Jeffrey Wright, both back in smaller roles. After both our Marvel and Venom movies, we also get yet another look at both Naomi Harris, Venom 2, and Lashana Lynch, Captain Marvel, the OG Rambo. Now, while I like the long-form story angle with the Bond movies, if you come into this film like I did, you might be kinda lost. I super remember Skyfall, like all of us, but I've probably only seen Spectre once or twice, and Quantum of Solace probably around that many times. So all the relations with older characters, Blofeld, Mr. White, there were just too much goings-on to come in as blind or unfamiliar as I did. So of course, the new ad I'm sure everyone was curious about, Mr. Robot star Rami Malek. Gosh, that show really was so good for USA Network. And you know what, I feel like the things I have to say about his character really start in the beginning. The beginning was a bit jarring, but seeing masked Rami Malek's villain in a menacing hunt to revenge his family was the best version of the villain. The motivations of young Madeleine, the daughter of Mr. White, since I had to look it up, defending herself is one thing, but Rami Malek deciding to help her doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And seeing them interact later, the age gap has me wondering, is he really that much older than her? I have many questions. But the cat and mouse hunt was some fun, huge stakes drama. Now, I did remember the Vesper Lynd death. I mean, that was iconic, with the water elevator lock sinking to her own death after semi-betraying Bond in Casino Royale. So once again, you do really have to know or remember some stuff of the franchise, and can't really come in cold turkey, wink wink, after Thanksgiving. Maybe you can come in with a cold cocktail, shaken, not stirred, and all that. Bond, you know, grieving for someone 4 movies ago, it's a nice thing, but I feel like these movies will be better if you watch all 5 at home in somewhat quick succession, maybe like 1 a day for a week. I feel like you'd get a lot more out of that overall story, and maybe it would be better. We'll see. Maybe one day I'll do my aggressive Bond rewatch and do a whole series of episodes, which I had planned on doing before all the life changes. So these Craig movies, they really torture our most recent James Bond. Like, they mess with his psyche. In the first movie, they made him think Vesper double-crossed him, and only after her death did he realize it wasn't her fault. But his assassination attempt at her tomb leads him to think the cycle of not trusting woman. He's close with, again, thinking, you know, Madeleine betrayed him, which she didn't. Again, trust issues aplenty. We can all relate to that probably in some capacity. Now, this movie does have some deeper franchise references too, not just franchise callbacks. The first one I was immediately keen on was the orchestral theme from On Her Majesty's Secret Service called We Have All the Time in the World. You know, we have all the time in the world. You know, it was in the Lazenby Bond movie that I'm not super familiar with plot-wise at all. You could be forgiven for not knowing that one as well. I don't want to say the worst Bond, but like the worst Bond for sure. But this movie also had Bond retire or come back to the place the whole film franchise started way back in 1962 in Jamaica, which was a fun touch. So the actual villain plan of another generic bioweapon is not the most exciting or unique inherently. The reason we love Skyfall so much is everything felt super personal to Bond. M, the Judi Dench one, and Javier Bardem's Silva. The Spectre thing in the following film felt a bit forced of everything being an inside job, especially with the mastermind villain from Sherlock clearly being a villain once again, from my distant memory of it all, at least. The virus story has a cool break-in sequence and some surprise humor, which in this scene and the movie overall, but that was it. And while I love Jeffrey Wright in this, the eventual reason Bond gets involved in seemingly just to spite MI6, I guess. Now, there was a clear Spectre setup moment that felt super similar to what we had come to expect with that movie's tone. But the flip of the deadly mist for Bond instead wiping out the entire Spectre organization was a fun reversal. The didn't see that coming moments in the movie, for sure something I gotta give them props for. I think the moment this movie really made me think, oh shoot, this got real, was when they killed Felix. I mean, the character has been played by a silly amount of actors, and while he never died, David Hedison's version in License to Kill did lose a leg to a shark attack. Should have had a shark repellent on him. So it is surprising that the actor who played him the most in movies, just three times, Jeffrey Wright was the first to actually bite it. I mean, the Judi Dench M death was the hardest Craig era Bond death to this point. But it just kept us on this loop of cleaning house in the final of five movies, a theme we will actually explore in all three of the movies being discussed in this episode. So while we finally see Waltz in his super brief role, look, the actor is amazing. He really is. Those Tarantino historical fiction pieces, sensational. He really makes those something special. I will still to this day say those are the best of the Tarantino movies, and I don't even think it's close. The trickery of wanting someone to poison Blofeld back to the Bond stuff, and it actually being Bond, who accidentally kills his own worst villain because of Rami Malek's crazy poison touch of interacting with databases and DNA strands. It's a bit much to suspend disbelief. But they were just flying through characters to kill off here. But one more Spectre setup of Waltz trying to make Bond think more woman betrayed him is something I for sure enjoyed in that moment, that last moment for his underwhelming character, unfortunately, since I really, really love Christoph Waltz. So with all of our James Bonds, we've gotten different representations. The wild and whimsical Roger Moore, the smart-talking and serious Sean Connery, the smooth and sleek Pierce Brosnan, the slightly more menacing Timothy Dalton. I normally think of his Bond from the Revenge one, but the Snow one with the orchestra assassin is like very good too. I think Timothy Dalton did a great job in his very short stint as James Bond. This Bond will always be, for Daniel Craig, a bit more personal and human. He was cool. Obviously, James Bond's got to be cool. But one great example of how this is how hard he takes all his losses. You see them all like take a toll on him. In this movie, when he realizes he might have a daughter with Madeline, you see him go to like crazy lengths to protect both of them. He goes to Terminator Bond mode. And when they get kidnapped by a super absent at times in this movie, Rami Malek, he gets the whole Bond squad together. Q, Moneypenny, M are all barely utilized here, but Lashana Lynch as the new 007 thankfully gets some action time to shine throughout the movie. The modern take on not being a Bond girl of old is a fun refresh of the formula. Also, speaking of franchise refreshes, Daddy Bond having to parent even for a bit was a fun change of pace for the franchise. We've seen this before. You know, tough action hero has to parent when ready for the new challenge. But it was fun and unique here, not so crony and cringeworthy. And yes, the base tear-through and menacing monologue acting is a bit formulaic. It is fun and exciting action to watch. I just wish Malek would have had more to do work with. The poison stuff is menacing and scary, sure, but I really thought he was at his best in the intro of the movie. Now, his final moment of poisoning Bond with a virus so he couldn't never be with the mother and child, Bond Jr., he ends up stopping generic villain plans and sacrificing himself in the process. Once again, emotional, long-lasting franchise deaths and cleaning house with literally killing our first Bond ever. It was pretty emotional. The MI6 squad, you know, Clink cheers his death with a drink and having that "We have all the time in the world" theme come back as Madalena tells their young daughter about her dad. A nice emotional end to a strong Bond stint for Craig and everyone else of these five films. It may not be the perfect end, but overall, it's good enough for me. And the biased Bond fan in me will really keep consuming all these spy flicks. I'm excited for what Craig will do in the future. I know Knives Out 2 is coming. But who do you think will be the next to helm the Bond franchise? Could it be Idris Elba? Tom Hardy? Henry Cavill? Tom Hiddleston after that AMC John Le Carré show, The Night Manager? Someone else? Let me know in the comments section on any of our social platforms, Twitter, Instagram, any of the other ones. Do that so we can get to the comfort food listening of our podcast, Slasher Things, for the hotly anticipated take by yours truly on Halloween Kills, which I think is still available on Peacock TV. If you haven't theater watched it yet, I mean, I would recommend theater watching it first, but you know, streaming platforms are good. We'll hold on to them for forever, but you know, the whole new-ish movie thing on streaming platforms, well, assumingly this is going away at the end of the year, but enjoy it while we have it. For starters, I had no clue how much of the past we would see in Halloween Kills. You know, they've done reboots a few times now, but this cast list should have been given us some clues. We knew we would see some 2018 characters back. The new surviving Strode woman with series vet OG Jamie Lee Curtis. The super good in the franchise Judy Greer, who I truly love in the Archer series. And maybe you also forgot she was briefly in Jurassic World? I know, right? See if you remember her in that reboot movie. I don't know if she'll be back for the final of this latest trilogy. The big fun back to the past ads were both Nancy Stevens as Marion Chambers, the nurse from the first one who died in the same movie series reboot, H2O, with a super young Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I know it's H20, but I'm going to keep reading as H2O for some reason. Charles Cyphers is back, also to reprise his role from the original Halloween movie, as he used to be Sheriff Brackett, now cast as more of an old man worn and torn from the incidents of the city where his, you know, daughter died. That was the other babysitter in the first one. The biggest disappointment, obviously, was not getting Paul Rudd to reprise his role as Tommy Doyle from the super weird Halloween 6, the one with Colts and multiple director's cut original ones. I, of course, have the director's cut because that's who I am, as you may already know. It's the one that gives Jamie Lloyd a little more to do. She's killed off pretty quickly after trying to make her a thing in 4, which is okay, and 5, which is downright terrible. Not the worst Halloween movie, as y'all know from my list, which is still on Letterboxd, but you know I'm not a fan of 5. So, what was Paul Rudd doing instead? Well, he was too busy in the new Ghostbusters Afterlife movie, which I'm pretty excited for. We'll be talking about that next episode, along with the latest from Marvel Eternals and the next installment of Bring Resident Evil to the Big Screen. Thankfully, the bye week is coming, so that gives me some time to get back to my movie ways and kind of get back to my groove. I gotta hit the gym a little more too, actually. But the biggest surprise was seeing some form of Dr. Sam Loomis, a face of the franchise played by the late Donald Pleasance. And like, he was in it much more than expected. He was name dropped a few times, but you expect that, especially in the first one, he was name dropped. But seeing him in the second one, like, well, I had no clue what was going on. We had seen this done a few times nowadays with aging or de-aging characters of, you know, Rogue One brought back people, both Peter Cushing and a much older Carrie Fisher, by using stand-in actors with CGI. But CGI Loomis was in this frequent and early, kind of like Peter Cushing in Rogue One as Moff Tarkin, Grand Moff Tarkin. Now, I do like it, and I've said this before, I appreciate lore not just being accepted and instead built on. Well, this is tough to do with decade-spanning stories. Star Wars did a pretty good job with it. But, you know, here in the Halloween franchise, they're constantly rebooting the franchise over and over again. You know, but they did an admirable job here with reinserting Will Patton playing Sheriff Hawkins as the older version. They put a younger version of him into that 78 timeline, having him exist in the first and second movies. Well, not the second one, because I forget the second one, as much as you think it would make sense, isn't actually a part of the latest canon. It's Halloween 1, first original one, and then the 2018 one, and now this latest trilogy will finish out their four-movie arc, I suppose. Everything's got to start at the first one, except for the god-awful Rob Zombie movies. So, never done. Never will stop making fun of those and how garbage they are. And if you're on it in a hurry, as this movie drops you off, like, initially, and you're back in that first movie world pretty quickly, as this movie drops you off, you would think initially, right after the 2018 moment, but even quicker, you're back in 1978 Haddonfield. And I really like the TLC that feels placed on this period of time. It really feels like something from that original movie, with the lighting, the coloring, the set design, acting, everything else, the dialogue. Call me a sucker for production values. Well, at least the cop part I really liked. I forgot how annoying kid bullying was in these movies, and it really is, like, up in it. The first six movies all have this. I mean, obviously the Rob Zombie movies went a little overkill with this, but kid bullying is all over the Halloween franchise, and it's always a little cringy, and that's no different here. That's actually a staple of the early Halloween movies, you know. Their weird attempt to make Jamie Lloyd a thing had tons of kid bullying in those weirder 4, 5, and 6 Halloween movies. But they pretty much made a new kid up to survive the olden times period to add a very useless adult character in the modern time. We will get to the odd balance of this movie overall. But for the most part, I did like the period piece part, especially giving Will Patton of, you know, 2004 John Travolta, Thomas Jane, Punisher fame, something to fight and hate Michael for even more. I will watch all of these and their diverging timelines, excluding the Rob Zombie ones and Season of the Witch. I don't own those three. I'm fine without that. You can't watch these and it all makes sense. In one watch through, it's just, you know, the timelines are jarring. But I like them all for what they are, and in this movie, I did enjoy the CGI Loomis moments. I was pretty about this in theaters at the first, like, true slasher to see in theaters. I don't count the last two Purge movies. They're really in a league of their own, for better or worse. Now, we will never know what Tommy was supposed to be in any continuation, or only real look at a, you know, non-barely explored kid. The only real look at this guy was the Paul Rudd version. And like Nancy Stevens or Charles Cyphers, this is what we have in the franchise. An angry, balding, bat-toting Tommy Doyle just somehow missed the mark of, you know, the brief character exploration we had seen from the character. They just made a character up with the same name, as far as I'm concerned. Gosh, if this hadn't been, you know, Ghostbusters Afterlife time, which I really am excited for, it could have been Paul Rudd. And that movie better be good with Paul Rudd. I've heard good things, but it better be good for what I would have think Paul Rudd would have brought to this role, and it just being better and not that. He would have looked the same, because he's an ageless wonder after all. Now, it takes a good chunk of time to get to the surviving Strode woman. You would think the movie would drop us right off here instead of bopping around the past. I mean, the first teaser trailer was them in the back of the truck right after the whole burning house thing. But they had to find a way to set things up simultaneously as other things were happening in the first movie. And here's where things got, I would say, really good. Yes, the trailer showed it off, but seeing Michael rampage through an entire fire department with axes and saws was something I didn't realize I needed. It was like, oh, shooting myself in the movie theater behind my mask. Simply glorious. The visuals and actors and the fight choreography and gore were sensational. I didn't go into Halloween thinking Pam Grier would be an MVP. But her journey from the first and second films, with her development and aggressive amounts of trauma from both her upbringing and the events of the first two movies, it was easily one of my favorite parts of the latest iteration of Haddonfield Halloween horror. The trauma exploration, it's my go-to. One of the many reasons the end of this film left me conflicted and a bit shocked. So, this first movie is littered with Michael rampage moments against, like, super random people, pretty much just a beeline to his old home is seemingly the entire plot. This film has 34 character deaths total, which seems high, but somehow feels low after watching the movie. If nothing else, this movie got Michael down pat with his menacing way of just existing and killing folks and his depravity of, in creative ways, doing such. This movie absolutely takes some weird tangents with the big and little John character, as well as the random other non-Michael patient. Let's remember, most of these movies aren't amazing. I think three are pretty good. Not three, I think three films are pretty good, because three would be Season of the Witch. I will watch most of them and enjoy them, but I gotta mention the parts of this one and the franchise as a whole that just aren't very good. Now, this movie does one more wild and out thing that the rest of the franchise never did, and made the whole town alive and brimming with people and anger. Somehow most of these movies feel so small in scale, but not this one. The whole town is rampaging around. Sure, Evil Dies Tonight is a rough calling card. Evil Dies Tonight, you'll hear it time and time again if you missed it the first dozen times. It's thrown all over the dialogue. Like the whole great power, great responsibility Spider-Man trope from the early days. We haven't heard it yet. I think we've been close in the MCU, but maybe if we get all three Spider-Mans, you know, we get Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire to join Tom Holland, maybe we'll hear it. It's all I can hope for. But the most singular amazing moment in the whole movie, I remember the first time I saw it, I said, holy cow, that's cool. It had Michael kicking a car door that hits someone just as they are shooting, and they end up shooting themselves. I mean, that made the scene, like, the whole, whoever made it was so smooth and nonchalant, and yet something like this would feel right at home in a John Wick movie, for sure. Gosh, I can't wait for my Keanu Lawrence Fishburne. I'm going to get half of that in the new Matrix, but I'll have to wait for John Wick 4 to get those two together again, apparently. The amount of misinformation spread in this movie, I'm sure there's some poignant reference, like the Purge movies would do, but like with nobody knowing what is going on and just romping around their town, lighting things on fire, like it's just crazy here as this movie goes. Kind of like the Purge movies, actually. I do kind of wish there was a little more direction in this movie, but if I turn my brain off for a bit, watch this, I actually think this is a really fun watch. The exact way people describe every Fast and Furious past, like the first one, which people forget was actually pretty good, even if Ludacris was not involved yet, sadly. So the hospital mob self-killing of a random not-Michael guy is something that makes you feel bad and everyone else with this whole mob mentality. Things come at you a mile a minute in this movie, but what doesn't happen is a ton of Laurie Strode doing things. I mean, she randomly needs some doctor in the balls for seemingly not doing a whole lot, which I'm pretty about from a hilarity standpoint, but you gotta imagine she's gonna have rightfully a larger role in the next film along with the remaining few survivors. It's a small list now, I'm pretty sure. Allegedly, that new movie is going to take place way in the past and maybe do something with COVID pandemic. I don't know how they're going to do it, but I don't know. I'm a little hesitant on this last one. I'm going to watch it, obviously, and hope for the best, but all those early rumors are a little concerning. But why are there so few people left from the second movie to the third movie? Well, Lonnie, the made-up kid from the kid bullying scene, goes into the Myers house solo. Went hilariously as well as expected. Made-up Lonnie was a waste of time for this movie, but another random guy to kill off. I may not like what they did with Tommy Doyle, but at least he has some form of a true personality. The house pre-ending is pretty interesting, if not for the aggressive end to previously douchey Cameron, the guy who was a total lame-o to Allison, our new final girl, or soon to be. There was a deleted scene of why he wasn't there, but I guess it doesn't make sense now with how he started off the second movie pretty much. But, you know, seeing Cameron get rocked by Michael was something to behold. This movie nailed the Michael Myers, like, vengeful nature of gore. Cameron getting repeatedly mounted on a stair banister was something to behold while Allison watched as he clung to life. That moment alone was, like, amazing. But not to be outdone, the end of this movie, or both ends, were just strong. Judy Greer pitchforking Michael into a trap by taking his mask and having him get taken to a massive mob, who seemingly wrecks his ish up badly. The turn of fate is awesome. Like, there's a good quote from Sheriff Brackett about everyone needs a good scare, and, like, that moment's great when you know what happened in the first movie. Tommy Doyle and more came, like, to take him out, and I love the twist. He puts on his mask and seemingly, you know, gets killed, but he's ready to mess some stuff up. But if we learned anything from the Jamie Kennedy Scream 3 Randy speech, this isn't the third one, but treat it as it is. Basically, in the third one, you gotta cryogenically freeze his head, decapitate him, or blow him up. And they surely did not do that. They needed to, like, super duper kill him, and after all this time, they just didn't do that for some reason. And therein lies the issue of this movie. Michael got up eventually and actually destroyed the entire mob after seemingly being dead, like he always does. But this time it's almost unbelievable. But they have a, you know, part three lined up, which I'm pretty sure it's called A Halloween End. So, you know, maybe that will be the end of Michael. And we'll see Michael die just like we saw James Bond die, for realsies. I mean, that has to happen. And, you know, now that that third one has to happen, guess Tommy's not making it to the sequel, and he had to die too. But the true crazy moment, this magical window that everyone is fascinated with and wants to see through, the way Michael did. For some reason, Judy Greer just has to go up there, and beyond belief, with all things considered, with her daughter seeing her from the entryway of the house, we got one final scare of Michael coming up right behind her, and seemingly killing the most interesting character of the new trilogy, who's not Jamie Lee Curtis. I mean, I guess they said, oh, maybe Judy Greer's not dead, but, you know, she got stabbed a few times, so I feel like she's pretty dead, at least. And lastly, this movie's saying Michael isn't actually obsessed with the Strode family, specifically Laurie is saying, I don't actually love at all. I don't need them to be siblings or anything else, or lovers, but come on, there has to be some confrontation. The whole reason Halloween is as close to Friday the 13th as it is the whole franchise, and it probably will end up being better, especially with how we haven't had a new entry in that franchise in ages, and the last one wasn't stellar. It's because there's a true connection at times between recurring Final Girl or Donald Pleasance. I'm excited to see how this ends, but overall, I enjoyed my time with the sophomore Halloween new trilogy. Not nearly as much as the first one, but turning off my brain, I enjoyed it. And yes, since we did a list of ranking episodes of the Halloween franchise already, where does Halloween Kills sit? Well, we will get to a Letterboxd stars rating shortly. We got one more movie to talk about. But for overall placement, I actually have it all the way at fourth, which sounds crazy. Thinking about it, it sounds crazy. Right under H20, but above Halloween 2, and that might seem outrageous, but 2 was a bit too small scale for me and for my liking. Halloween Kills might have a bunch going on and made a bold claim about the relationship between Michael and Laurie, but I got a really enjoyable kick out of seeing a fully realized and lived-in town of Haddonfield. If you want to check out the full Halloween franchise list, including a change from my previous look at the franchise, take a gander at my profile on Letterboxd. But before you get to the Social Supreme movie website, let's check out the newest sci-fi epic Dune to round out the new to theaters event, was new to theaters trilogy. Okay, so you can't stream the new Dune on HBO Max anymore. Heartbreaking. The original is there, but for some reason, this isn't nearly as exciting as a prospect. I have not seen the original movie attempt. There's apparently a miniseries. I have not read the book. Really, I just wanted to watch one final movie in Amherst before the big move to Green Bay. And with the last few days before the Penske packing commenced, I figured, why not watch the latest big-budget expansive sci-fi movie? I was going to watch it on streaming, but this big epic, they were right, should be viewed at least once in theaters. So I made my way to Cinemark one final time, strapped in for a 2.5 hour cinematic experience, and away I went. When I first looked at this movie, it didn't immediately draw me in by the plot, but the cast sure did. I don't know if I will ever see House of Gucci, not necessarily my bag, but if there is one thing that movie has in common with Dune, it's a loaded cast. To name a few, Dune has Timothée Chalamet, who is taking the acting world by storm, and eventually introduced Zendaya, who I can't wait to see in the alleged Spider-Man trilogy finale. It also has Oscar Isaac, Jason Momoa, Josh Brolin, Javier Bardem, and Dave Bautista. Also, I may not super know Rebecca Ferguson by name, but she was Rose the Hat in Doctor Sleep. And for how many times David Dastmalchian has been brought up on this podcast, the super fun character actor who you all should know as Polka Dot Man in Suicide Squad. Suicide Squad was a 2016 one that we're still waiting for the air cut. The Suicide Squad was the one that just came out that was actually pretty funny. So, fun treat to see him and realize who it was in this movie, because it wasn't obvious. So yeah, actors alone in this were fire. Do I know everyone's character names after seeing this movie once? Couldn't watch it again. I really wanted to watch it again before doing this episode, but for sure I don't. House Atreides, Duncan Idaho, Gunnery or Gunny, something like that for Josh Brolin's guy. That's it. Those are the ones I remember. Overall, I don't remember a ton of the name things or planets and people and wearing factions. I had to look some stuff up, and you'll hear me use the buzzwords as this goes. But they treat spice, I'm gonna say, similar to Star Wars, but like not even close, actually. In Star Wars, it's, you know, it's a money crop and it's good. It's more of an illegal drug. Here, I guess the spice is even more valued because it's how they like jump to light speed. I know that's a Star Wars word and that's not the word they use here, but that's, you know, Star Wars. I mean, I know deep lore things for Harry Potter. I have all the Lord of the Rings books. And yes, I know a lot of Star Wars. I've seen a lot of the shows, the movies, obviously, and I have an aggressive amount of books on my bookcase. So I couldn't, you know, say that I don't understand how to dive in deep lore. I could eventually be all about the deep lore here, but I have this sneaking suspicion I will wait for the second movie, thankfully it's announced, and see how many more movies get made in an apparently 6 main novel series with countless other stories and spin-offs. I had no clue there was so much Dune content out there. I have all the Game of Thrones books, you know, still have barely read past the first one since I just have the show and that got me to the story. I swear I do read things, even with media versions out there. I just set up my wooden bookcase for my grandpa in my new apartment, after all, and it's loaded with books. But enough about random Nick family things. Let's get into the many families and stories of the first Dune movies. So in short, there was a super nice water planet. Could be a Naboo or something. Maybe not that fancy. It seemed a little more militaristic than Naboo in Star Wars. You know, they got this big old army and a fun ruling family with a ton of different kooky characters. They're going to have to take the Emperor's request. Star Wars me says not to trust emperors that we never meet here. And go peacefully run this crazy spice desert planet instead of peacefully from these super creepy other house of makeup laden Dave Bautista, Dave Dastmalchian. And of course, another Marvel actor in Stellan Skarsgård, who plays a creepy floating guy, not to be confused with Bill Skarsgård, who plays Pennywise in the latest It movies. But this other family in this Dune movie, it's a weird group, weird AF. I like weird things. I like weird movies. I like weird things in this specific movie. But some stuff was just too weird. Mostly related to this House Harkonnen, whatever that person spider thing is. I don't like that. As you know, spiders big as houses, not good for me. Spiders maybe even people size is not good for me. Not about it. Not my thing. So, you know what I did like, though? The music score by legendary composer Hans Zimmer. I also really like the visuals in this Denis Villeneuve movie. There's some cool stuff in this movie, and the overall political intrigue and backstabbing, with the set dressing of sci-fi reminding me of some high fantasy stuff. As a GOT Game of Thrones fan, the stuff was all in my bag. The idea of the emperor giving over a whole economic boost to a different bigwig family, only to have that same initial family exists to eradicate this other house with the empire, like, of the whole, I guess, all of space and his backing and his soldiers. That part was never super clear who owned what and all that stuff. And I have to feel that needs to be, you know, I could super dive in and research it. Nothing wrong with it. I just feel like I'll just wait for the sequel instead, or at least a trailer before I get too jazzed about all that stuff. But Oscar Isaac's house patriarch always seems like a good guy, wanting to befriend the desert people, especially the fighters, you know, and rule it all together, and it seems very cute and idyllic. But if things just worked like that, it would be a very short and boring movie. And to quote Lola Scumpy from Netflix's Big Mouth, one of the many shows I am season at least behind on, I am all about the drama. And this may feel like a slow burn, but like another Netflix show I have talked about on here, Midnight Mass, I truly think they're both worth it. Hopefully with Dune, you know, I suppose we're waiting for a part two, but hopefully things will pan out. Also, random observation, Junkie XL and Hans Zimmer took very similar approaches to the assignment of the soundtracks for these, making chanty hymn music, you know, in the true version of Justice League. Whenever Wonder Woman does anything, in this movie, Dune, you get these lady chorus vocals. I know some people jest about them in the Snyder cut of Justice League, but I like them here and I like them there. You know, they're just fun. Those are things I can listen to on Spotify. So Chalamet doesn't just have cool military leadership experience because of Oscar Isaac, Poppy, or fun war training from Josh Brolin, and way more fun Jason Momoa. He also gets to learn how to be a space witch, even though it's supposedly to be more, you know, ladies' night only. I don't know all the powers, but I guess the big one is more like you can super just tell people what to do. Sounds like a Jedi mind trick to me, young apprentice. Star Wars for life. This space witch group is like a semi-secret religious group that was not super about a guy being even a fringe member of their sect, much less a potential savior of the whole galaxy, universe, whatever space word you want to use to describe everything. So when he puts his hand in up a strange pain box for some test due to all the crazy Zendaya dreams, I guess they know he's like the real deal. And apparently, this should save him from the coup that seemingly is not so secret and like just about everyone knows about. Not Jason Momoa or Oscar Isaac or even Josh Brolin know about it, but everyone else is pretty up on the goings-on of coup life. So, love the build-up of this movie overall. They have a lot of stuff that has to be set up in a really short time. I like the visuals a lot. Once we get to see a non-dream version of Arrakis, the desert planet, it looks massive and haunting, and they did a good job. It looks pretty. I don't hate that sand. No Anakin Skywalker. I hate the sand. It's coarse and rough and it gets everywhere. But you're not like sand, and that's why I love you. Oh, what writing. Brings a tear to your eye every time. See, I can say not so amazing things about Star Wars as much as I love Star Wars. But this movie, I do get a bit slowed down at times, trying to figure out the spice mining process and things with the sandworms and the weird walking they have to do. Pretty much being left nothing to do to make all this spice stuff. It seems like a doozy, little no government help, you know, I can't mind that spice. I really feel like the government is so obviously doing nothing to help, and it feels like there's an issue, and like, we know that they aren't going to help and there's an issue, but it doesn't make anything less unsuspicious in this movie. The middle portion of this movie really kind of slows down. There are some trippy dream sequences, big ol' sandworms, and yeah, there's some budding friendships with House Atreides, and the local Furman. There is some neat info to dive into, but at the end of the day, the real moment we're all waiting for is the Game of Thrones, like, red wedding, purple wedding, whatever wedding you want to talk about, political coup. Almost a full extinction level event, similar to the House Stark season 1 and 2 moments. I was all about this, the betrayals, the battles, the personal shield bubble things were a bit tough to make sense of, and not as cool as, like, I don't know, Star Wars lightsabers and stuff, sorry. I hope that's the last Star Wars reference, but can't promise it. Overall, seeing everyone and everything fall apart, I was all about it. I mean, dark and depressing Nick on the scene. Not great for Oscar Isaac in this movie, who I was all about, especially if the whole betrayal thing was all a farce that didn't even matter. But having Oscar Isaac try and get everyone with the old poison in the teeth trick, at least that was something. Not sure why I had to be naked for this, but still a fun final hurrah moment. I do love seeing Jason Momoa make it out because, you know, no one can stop him, obviously. We never see what happens to Brolin, but assumedly he'll be back in the sequel. I think there's some space worm riding, maybe. It's like the only thing I really know about the sequel is I think he's back into space worm riding. I mean, we also get to see some nice Chalamet and his mom. You know, they get to do the voice thing and have an action-packed moment with that. And that's good. He has to learn how to use it so he can use it and be really good at voice speaking to people later on. Assuming the voice space witch cult will have more to do here. As opposed to this movie, which had more moderate moments of existing. So obviously the spice stuff goes right back to the other bad guy family. There's not a lot of gray morality here. I mean, I guess there is a fair amount of morality, gray hero type characters, but the villains are obviously villains. Things seem like they will get better at this point. Maybe they'll start like an underground resistance and, you know, well, Jason Momoa knows all the Furman because he went there early. So, you know, that'll be something cool. And, you know, Game of Thrones stuff, I like it. So Jason Momoa, all about Aquaman, you know, hanging out with Duncan Idaho. Great name for a character. But I guess somehow things have to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, he can't stop and save everybody. He takes a lot of people out and goes down like a boss. And, you know, I forget what her name is, the Furman, like, government representative did something fun with that too, kind of like, she lured some people away and started hitting the sand. And if you hit the sand, you know, the big old sandworm's going to eat you up like that. But that was cool, too. A big sandworm eat up moment. And yeah, they have to do their dumb little sand walk eventually. But when we do finally see Zendaya, it's like so close to the end. We do get some nice Javier Bardem, too. This is a full moment of pure setup and teasing for the sequel. Thank goodness they got, you know, approved for that, because that was not the case. They weren't known they were going to have a second movie when they made this. But, you know, it's great to see, you know, we saw Paul have to get better at using his voice, and now we see him actually have to fight somebody after all the training he supposedly had from Brolin and Momoa. Character names, who needs them? Duncan Idaho, great name, though. But when you got this many name brand actors, who needs them? And it was a fun movie overall. I liked that Paul had to, you know, kill a guy and, you know, do some actual fighting and, you know, something something Zendaya, and that's the end, I think. Fun movie. Perfect? No. Fun, cool, and weird? Hell yes. I'm pretty excited for the sequel. I wish I could have rewatched on HBO Max, since it feels like ages since I've seen most of these movies, but we're back with an episode, and now let's get them Letterboxd ratings out there. I know you're rooting on them, so here's what I got. I might feel a little high to have Halloween Kills at 3.5 stars, but it was fun. I'm pissed about the Tommy Doyle stuff. I'm pissed about a few odds and ends in this movie, but it was a fun movie. And at the end of the day, movies are supposed to be fun. So at least some of them are. And this was a fun movie. No Time to Die, 4 stars. I love the trajectory they had with Bond. I think they underused Rami Malek, but I think it was a good wrap-up. And I'm very excited for the future of Bond. And I'm really excited to do a full Daniel Craig 5-movie watch-through at some point. And Dune, I gave it 4, too. You could say, oh, Dune's so good and perfect. And Dune is very fun to watch, and it's very nice and pretty. And I like the story and the political stuff, and I like Jason Momoa, and all the actors are pretty good. But sometimes it does drag a little bit. And I like slow burns. I really do. Doesn't mean I need to give every art film. I don't think Dune is an art film, probably. But doesn't mean I need to give every film that's supposed to be for the cinema a 5. I like what I like. And I like Dune, and just 4 stars of what it is. Those are the latest catch-up films I've been meaning to get around to from, you know, yours truly, tackling some new at-the-time movies that were
floating around theaters. All three of these I saw at the Amherst Cinemark before moving to Wisconsin to start a new sports video gig. And with it comes a new movie theater to which I'll be watching all of these glorious flicks in. So join me as I settle into some semblance of movie viewing and reviewing on this podcast. Next episode, hopefully next week, should be fine with the bye week. We will see if, time permitting, this stays weekly or bi-weekly. We will see zombies, Game of Thrones reunions in a Marvel movie, and the Paul Rudd action we were missing in Halloween Kills, this time with the legendary Bill Murray, who will apparently be joining the Marvel fray at some point. My money is on the Blade movie. Kidding. But I can dream. It's an Ant-Man, reportedly. So that's all the time, and it feels good to say this again, hopefully much sooner next time than last time. Till next time, cinephiles.
Are you not entertained?
I think this is gonna be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
I don't like goodbyes. Let's just call this see you later, alligator.